Welcome to Securing America with me, Frank Gaffney, the program that's a kind of owner's manual for protecting the country we love against all enemies, foreign and domestic, to God's glory and that of his kingdom. The domestic piece of the enemy we face is a theme to which we return again and again because we must. It's evident that there are those inside the United States who are intent on doing damage to us, and to varying degrees, it's pretty clear that they collaborate with enemies external to our country. We have, in the person of Robert Spencer, a man who has studied both of these classes of adversaries for many years. He has done so notably through the vehicle of his myriad books on Islam and related subjects, his work at the David Horowitz Freedom Center's excellent project, jihadwatch.org, and in his writings, Front Page Magazine and Jamis Media. And we're delighted to have him with us always, PJ Media. Robert Spencer, thank you for joining us for a full hour, as it happens. And we're going to start by talking about your most recent book, The Sumter Gambit, How the Left is Trying to Foment a Civil War. It's hard to imagine a more dangerous proposition in terms of enemies within than people who are bent on provoking Americans to kill one another, as they did back in the 4 years that followed an attack on Fort Sumter at the start of the Civil War. We've talked about pieces of the book over time, but I'm very pleased to say we have a time here today to really drill down on the thesis of the piece, which is that past is prologue, as they say. Welcome. It's good to have you, my friend, as always.
Good to talk to you, Frank, as always. Thank you.
Let's start with the run-up to the last Civil War. I remember from our previous conversations that there was a lot of jockeying for position, I guess you might say, between Abraham Lincoln, the newly inaugurated president of the United States, and those in South Carolina who didn't want any part of being under his rule in South Carolina. Walk us through some of that backstory, Robert, that gets us to the point where violence was initiated, not just in South Carolina, but across the South.
Well, the previous president, Frank, James Buchanan, was willing to let the whole thing go and just let the country dissolve and let the South become its own separate nation. Now, Lincoln, on the other hand, thought that this was against his constitutional responsibilities to put down an insurrection against the federal government. And so he acted. The thing was, though, that he knew that if they were going to curry favor with Britain and France, which of course were quite a bit more powerful than the United States at that time, then he had to not start a conflict. But a conflict was pretty much inevitable. And both sides were trying to maneuver the other into starting the conflict. The whole thing started, of course, over Fort Sumter in Charleston Harbor, South Carolina. And the thing was, the South declared its independence. And it's not as if Union troops decamped and withdrew from the South. They just became Confederates. They were all there. And they were mostly sympathizers, so they simply joined the new entity. But in Fort Sumter, even though it was commanded by a general from Kentucky, Robert Anderson, he was not a Southern sympathizer. And he remained with the Union and kept the fort in Union hands. But then they could no longer go into Charleston to get food for the people in the fort, because Charleston was now a hostile foreign country. And so Lincoln had to send a ship to resupply the fort. But the South said, this is going to be an act of war. If you do that, this is our fort, our territory, and we will consider that an act of war. So Lincoln was caught. He could either acquiesce and say, yes, the South is a separate country, or he could resupply the fort and thus touch off the war. But as far as he was concerned, that was acceptable because the South would have started it then if they attacked first, and that made a big difference for world opinion. Now, the reason why all this is relevant today is because the left is trying to maneuver patriots into the same kind of win-win situation for themselves. They are pushing their increasingly insane agenda upon us. The transgender business, the drag queens, all the whole nine yards, and expecting us either to accept it submissively and go along and just surrender, in which case they win, or else fight back. And if they fight back, they can say, you see, they are the insurrectionists that we've been saying they are, and clamp down with more authoritarian measures. So as far as they're concerned, that way, either way, they would win. And that's what the title of the book, The Sumter Gambit, is all about: the attempts by the left to push the right into either surrendering or fighting back in a way that they can use to make it even worse.
Robert, we'll come to the present moment, but I just have a question for you that, based on your research, might be instructive in what's afoot at the moment. But also, as we have witnessed statues being torn down, military bases having their names changed, you know, a main thrust, really, of the left's assault against America being doing what Marxists always do, which is to try to rewrite history or disassociate people from their historical realities. You mentioned that the commanding officer of Fort Sumter was from Kentucky, but was not sympathetic to the Southern cause. You mentioned that there were lots of others in the South, Robert E. Lee comes to mind, who were proud members of the United States Army and military, but who felt the call of solidarity with his native state, in Lee's case of Virginia, of course. What were they fighting over, Robert, as you see it? Was it slavery in the end, states' rights, or something else?
Well, you know, in a certain sense, it's a both and rather than an either or. The slavery issue was indeed the issue that touched off the war, and it's become sort of shorthand nowadays with all the racial divisions in modern day American society to make it a very easy binary that the South was pro-slavery and therefore evil, and the North was anti-slavery and therefore good. Whereas the issue for Robert E. Lee...
Or for the left, if not good exactly, maybe not so bad, or yes, as yes. bad at least. Yeah,
indeed. But for Lee, since you mentioned him, he actually even said that he would free all the slaves and accept the abolitionist program if it could preserve the Union. So why did he go to war against preserving the Union? Because he considered himself, in the old fashion, a citizen of Virginia first, and considered the United States to be a plural, a compact of independent states that could voluntarily leave the compact if they so chose. And since his first loyalty was to Virginia, he went with them.
Let me interrupt you for just a moment. We'll be right back with more on the other side of a very short break with Robert Spencer, an historian, as well as a student of what history teaches us, the author of The Sumter Gambit, right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The more we learn about Joe Biden's record of selling out our country to the Chinese Communist Party, the more urgent becomes the obvious question. Is the President of the United States a controlled asset of history's greatest existential threat to freedom, the CCP? That's the professional judgment of Charles Sam Faddis, a man who, as a career CIA undercover operative, recruited and ran spies and other assets for our country. The latest Committee on the Present Danger of China webinar powerfully affirmed that assessment. It's hard to overstate the resulting danger for America, given that the Chinese Communist Emperor Xi Jinping is preparing to go beyond the CCP's long-running, pre-kinetic, unrestricted warfare and launch the shooting kind against Taiwan and us. That prospect can only be more certain if a man who works for them is supposed to defend us. Joe must go. This is Frank Affney. Welcome back to this very special edition of Securing America. We have as our guest for the full hour, Robert Spencer, extraordinarily prolific author of books on a host of subjects, many of them having to do with various threats to our republic, often in the form of what the Sharia supremacists, the way I think of them, have in mind for us, submission. Enslavement, ultimately perhaps mass death in the favor of a caliphate that would rule the entire world. We'll be talking with him about that in a bit, but for the moment we're focused on the left, often allied with the Sharia supremacists, to be sure, but we're talking specifically about what Robert has described in his new book, The Sumpter Gambit, is the agenda of the left in terms of trying to foment a new civil war in our country. And Robert, you mentioned racial divisions as an element of, well, what of course was in play in the original Civil War. But it seems very much to be part of what I think of as a Marxist cultural revolutionary effort in our time. Mao, of course, being the guy who kind of invented the cultural revolution. He used class warfare, of course, in China to try to come to power and then to rule misrule. The many millions and millions of Chinese and others. In this country, the technique is pretty much the same, to divide and conquer, but the division fault line appears to be racism rather than class. Talk us through what the left is doing to weaponize race in our time for fratricidal purposes.
Well, you can take, for example, the 1619 Project, which tries to claim falsely that there was slavery in America for 300 years. The way that this is done is to backdate the founding of the nation from 1776 to 1619, and then to extend the existence of slavery into the 20th century, essentially. So to make this 300-year figure, which of course is completely unhistorical,
just so we're clear, 1619 was when the first slave ship arrived in the United States. Yes. Is that right?
Yes, and so you have that is designed to foster racial resentment and division today. All of the left's historical forays are all designed to manipulate people in the present, and this is no different. The idea is to set white and black Americans against each other to such an extent that authoritarian measures will be necessary. And this is why this is an essential element of the Marxist program, which, of course, is totalitarian at its core. And so the racial divisions in the United States are worse now than they have been in decades, probably since the Jim Crow era. When you go back to 2008, and it looked as if racial disharmony was a thing of the past, but Barack Obama stoked it throughout his administration. And then Biden has only worked to make it worse, while culturally these critical race theory programs have been implemented by corporations and schools all over the country to foster these false claims about systemic racism that only are designed to pave the way for an authoritarian government.
I want to sort of tease out very important points that you've just made. Robert, I think it's fair to say that an enormous number of white Americans, certainly Democrats, but I think independents and maybe even some Republicans, voted for Barack Obama as both an expression of what you just said, that this is all now behind us, that this is some way of specifically and very symbolically demonstrating that race is no longer a feature of our polity, but also very much in the hope that to the extent there was any residual, I don't know, embers, I guess you might say, that were still out there, that they would be tamped down. And to the contrary, what we saw was a man who came to office professing that he was going to effect a fundamental transformation of the United States, did from virtually day one, in subtle ways maybe, in other cases rather more blatantly, promoting this idea that there is racism in the police and there's racism in the society more generally. And at the end of his, I call them the first two terms, because I believe we're really in the third Obama-Biden term right now, markedly worse relations between blacks and whites, though, as you certainly have said, this term, with Obama very much in the mix, but not as visibly so, not as identifiably responsible, we're watching the racial tensions greatly intensified. I got that about right, do you think?
Absolutely, yes. And this is a deliberate effort. This is a very carefully planned effort to put these programs that foster racial resentment and mutual suspicion and distrust in every aspect of American life. And the idea is to create an ongoing pretext for outright violence that will both endanger people who are trying to live lives, quiet and stable lives in America, and make it necessary for the government to impose what will essentially be a police state in order to keep the peace.
So, Robert, was the so-called Summer of Love an expression of this agenda and action on it, would you say? This would be the summer of 2020 and Black Lives Matter and Antifa and the riots and the mass destruction and loss of life?
Very much so. That was a foretaste of the kind of thing that's going to happen if Americans make the mistake of electing a president who is not part of the socialist internationalist elite again. The idea in the summer of 2020 was to make Americans afraid, essentially to terrorize Americans into submission and make them think that if Trump remains president, there will be more of these riots. People will be coming into my neighborhood. They'll be breaking the windows of my house. I won't be able to defend myself. Whereas Biden will come in and restore order. And certainly you can see that as soon as Biden became president, then suddenly Antifa and Black Lives Matter stopped rioting. And so the agenda behind the riots was clear. And of course, at the same time, this doesn't mean that normalcy was actually restored, because the Biden administration has been actively working toward authoritarian goals and striving above all to criminalize, do nothing less than criminalize, dissent from its agenda. We can see this in its abortive attempt to implement a disinformation governance board, in its efforts to work with Twitter and the other social media giants to silence people who opposed its agenda regarding the COVID vaccines, and in other measures to combat what it calls hate speech and disinformation, which are actually, of course, subjective terms that are used to stigmatize people who they then want to silence.
This is where we're going to pick up on the other side of a short break. The othering phenomenon, the means by which you further intensify the resentments and prospects for conflict, fratricidal though it may be. Robert Spencer, the author of The Sumpter Gambit, will be with us to explore all of that and much more on the other side of this short break. Stay tuned.
In cities across the country, black garbed assailants clash with police in the streets, smash windows, and throw Molotov cocktails in an effort to destroy police stations, federal courthouses, and local businesses, all in the name of anti-fascism. Most Americans are now, sadly, all too aware of the movement known as Antifa. But where did they come from? What do they want? And how do we stop their campaign of violent mayhem? The Center for Security Policy Press is proud to present Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat. This new book looks at the history, ideology, organization, finances, and strategy of Antifa, and provides an in-depth analysis for law enforcement officers, policymakers, and the general public. From street fighting tactics of the Black Bloc to fundraising by prominent left-wing foundations, Unmasking Antifa is the go-to guide to understand this elusive and dangerous threat. Get your copy of Unmasking Antifa: Five Perspectives on a Growing Threat at Amazon.com.
Welcome back. The extraordinary Robert Spencer is in the house virtually. We have always been delighted to catch up with him, but especially when we have a chance to do so in a deep dive fashion, as we are doing today. He is talking with us at the moment about the thrust of his new book entitled The Sumpter Gambit, about how the left is trying to foment a new civil war in America. Robert, you were talking there about this idea that this revolution, this Marxist revolution, I would call it, has at its core the idea of turning Americans against one another, using race as a pretext, the institutionalization, really, of a new form of racism. I mean, it's kind of Jim Crow turned on its head with, you know, blacks primarily, people of color, they sometimes say, but principally blacks, as the oppressed, needing to be privileged because the privileged whites continue to exhibit and can't help themselves but exhibit a racist attitude towards their black fellow citizens. All of which is reinforced by provocations and disorder and bloodletting in some cases, notably in the summer of 2020, further intensified by what happened, I would argue, on January 6th, though it wasn't primarily about racial divides. It was a further example of what can happen to you if you don't go along, as you say, with the program of the left in Congress, in the executive branch, on the eve of the restoration of the left's presidency. Obama, I would argue, certainly in the wings, if not on center stage. Biden, of course, in the White House. So, Robert, when you put all that together, did the response to January 6th and the categorization of large numbers of Americans, which has been a steady theme, particularly Biden, as domestic terrorists or violent extremists or others, as they say, translate into, you know, further intensification beyond race of, you know, hostilities between Americans, obviously for the purpose of exploiting them to consolidate power on the left part.
Yeah, you know, Frank, the worst example, the foremost example of what you're talking about here was Biden's ominous red and black speech of September 1st, 2022. It's called, of course, the red and black speech because of the very strange, ominous background using the colors of Nazi Germany in the lighting that was behind him. And then there were two Marines behind him as well, presenting a kind of unspoken threat that behind his words was the full might of the U.S. military. Now, Biden
with the glowing gloves, it seemed to me, suggesting, you know, the iron fist in the velvet glove. No?
Indeed. And Biden said in that speech that Donald Trump and the MAGA Republicans are a threat to the very foundations of the Republic. Now, this is an extraordinary statement. There has never been, in over 200 years of American history, another president who has ever said in any context for any reason that his primary opponent and the primary opponent's supporters represent a threat to the Republic. It has always been taken for granted by both Democrats and Republicans that the other side had an acceptable point of view. That was a fundamental assumption on which the American Republic has been based, that both sides had reasonable points to make, and that in their give and take and compromise and mutual respect, there would come workable solutions for the various problems the nation faced. Now, though, the president of the United States has essentially said that half of the electorate and his main rival are outside the bounds of what's acceptable political discourse in the United States. That's the kind of thing that happens in banana republics, in dictatorships, in Nazi Germany with the Reichstag fire that Hitler blamed on his principal opponents and was able to outlaw their parties. It's the same thing now, but it's never happened in America before. And it's a very dangerous step toward the authoritarian rule that the left clearly wants.
And in the wake of January 6th, of course, and the speech and so on, we've seen, it seems, the weaponization of the security apparatus of the United States government. The intelligence services, the FBI, arguably the military as well. And not only in terms of their internal, you know, reorientation, shall we say, and this is particularly dramatic, of course, inside the military, but at the very minimum, the leadership of all of these entities has now really embraced the idea that they're is this vast cohort of domestic terrorists and MAGA Republicans who are, you know, threats to the Republic, as you say, and who are bringing to bear to varying degrees, overtly, but certainly implicitly, the power of the state to try to punish in some cases or intimidate, coerce, and threaten the rest of us. And Banana Republic doesn't even seem to describe it. It seems to me it's really full-on authoritarianism now a building. Would you agree?
Oh, absolutely, Frank. That's exactly what the agenda is here. And it's quite clear that when you take all these things together, and I do tie them together in the book, the Disinformation Governance Board, the Twitter files, the attempts to silence the dissidents, the demonization of the entire conservative population in the country, it's all very clear that what they're working toward is the criminalization of dissent, so that only the perspective of the regime and its media establishment will be allowed to be enunciated. And any other perspective, if spoken publicly, will be taken as a sign that one is an insurrectionist, a January 6th, MAGA Republican, and consequently the full weight of the law enforcement apparatus will be brought down upon such people.
And the extent to which that has destroyed the targets of such campaigns, notably with, you know, people who trespassed in the Capitol without violence, without even breaking anything to get in, being held in some cases indefinitely without judicial proceedings or review, in other cases in solitary confinement. And I mean, all of this is unmistakably intended to be a threat, a palpable threat, conditioning us to conform and submit, is it not?
Definitely. It's designed to terrorize the population into submission. And that's how Marxist governments have always worked. Everywhere they've been implemented, there's a reign of terror. What people don't realize is that the Biden regime has already started its reign of terror even before its authoritarian apparatus is fully in place. The idea behind persecuting those people who were let into the Capitol by officers who opened the doors, and most of whom stood around taking selfies and not having the slightest clue that they were doing anything illegal. The fact that these people have been held without charge, that they've been held in solitary confinement, that they've been, as many people have documented, held under incredibly inhumane conditions, all that is designed to send the signal to the rest of Americans who might support Trump, who might not like Biden, who might not like the left in general, get out of line and this will happen to you.
Robert, let me ask you about the full apparatus that you say is not yet in place. What is it you're looking to see instituted that isn't actually now, in, even if it's just in preliminary form, being institutionalized by the Biden or Obama-Biden third term team?
Frank, what's coming is the destruction of the First Amendment and particularly of the freedom of speech. And all that, it's very clear, the mechanism to do that is well on the way to being put fully in place, that the kind of conversation you and I are having today, the any kind of public dissent from administration policies will be classified as hate speech and or disinformation and misinformation. And for the protection of the American people, the offending speech will be removed, and eventually the speaker, if he persists or she persists, will be prosecuted and probably imprisoned. You might think, well, that's crazy. This could never happen in the United States. Well, consider one particular example that's already happened. There was a fellow, Douglas Mackey, who was a meme artist on Twitter in 2016. And it's a joke, it's a little quip, but he put up a poster that was designed to look like a vote for Hillary poster, only it said vote by text, which of course you couldn't do. And so he was convicted recently of committing election fraud, trying to divert people from voting, and faces 10 years in prison. There was a Hillary supporter.
Hold the thought, Robert. We have to take a very short break. We'll be right back with more on the tale of disinformation and cancellation right after this. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The more we learn about Joe Biden's record of selling out our country to the Chinese Communist Party, the more urgent becomes the obvious question. Is the President of the United States a controlled asset of history's greatest existential threat to freedom, the CCP? That's the professional judgment of Charles Sam Faddis, a man who, as a career CIA undercover operative, recruited and ran spies and other assets for our country. The latest Committee on the Present Danger China webinar powerfully affirmed that assessment. It's hard to overstate the resulting danger for America, given that the Chinese Communist Emperor Xi Jinping is preparing to go beyond the CCP's long-running, pre-kinetic, unrestricted warfare and launch the shooting kind against Taiwan and us. That prospect can only be more certain if a man who works for them is supposed to defend us. Joe must go. This is Frank Gaffney. Welcome back. We are continuing this hour-long conversation with one of the most interesting, thoughtful, and I think insightful people that we have the privilege of knowing and working with. A man who, by the way, is a senior fellow of our Center for Security Policy, as well as the author of 24, 25, who knows how many books, including the one we've been discussing, The Sumter Gambit, about how the left is trying to foment a new civil war in America. And Robert, I had to interrupt you there, but you were making the point that yet to be instituted is another element of the authoritarian agenda that specifically uses the state to enforce limitations on speech as a means, limitations on speech as a means of straining the population and bending it to the will of what are, in fact, totalitarians. Finish this thought, if you would, because it seems as though with disinformation boards and with the prosecutions, we're fairly far along on the road towards the suspension of our First Amendment freedoms. And I have to ask you, is it likely that in due course, Second Amendment freedoms are also likely to be constricted?
Yeah, very much so, Frank. That's it actually all goes together, that once speech that dissents from the regime's line is criminalized, then you also have to disarm the populace so that they don't have any way to fight back, either peacefully through peacefully, lawfully enunciated dissent or through resistance to a totalitarian incursion. And so you can't have citizens defending themselves against a rogue totalitarian government because they don't have any weapons, and you can't have them saying anything. So the slavery of the populace would be complete. And
Robert, you know, one of the things that I've been worrying about for some time now, and we've actually launched a campaign to try to counter it under the rubric of what we call the Sovereignty Coalition, is something we had a very, I think, impressive press conference concerning on Capitol Hill earlier in the week. And that is the use of an international organization that is notorious for its, well, not just ineptitude, but its malfeasance in the course of the COVID pandemic, what I call Pandemic 1.0. And that would be the World Health Organization, to try to use it as a means of, in an extra constitutional way, for sure, anti-constitutional way, accomplish things like the suspension of the Second Amendment, the seizure of guns, even at the instigation of some international organization, including the World Health Organization, or most especially it. And I would just ask, because the idea being that the Biden administration is beavering away at trying to give the World Health Organization additional powers to dictate when we and others have a public health emergency of international concern. And then dictate as well what we must do about it. And it's just always been something I think that is lurking in the wings in all of that, that it's not a pandemic, to be sure, and it may not even really be properly described as a public health emergency, but gun violence may nonetheless be so deemed by Tedros Ghebreyesus, a communist picked by the Chinese Communist Party to run the World Health Organization, if he gets these kinds of powers, and thereby establishes that all those guns, which represent a threat of gun violence, must be confiscated, and the United States government is ordered by this international body to do just that. Does that sound beyond the pale, given what you've studied, what you've learned, what you've written about in terms of this, effort to take down our country from within by the radical left?
Unfortunately, it's very much within the realm of possibility. We live in an age where just a few years ago, things that would have been dismissed as inconceivable are now happening. This is an internationalist regime. We can see that very clearly with the erasure of the southern border and the what is very clearly a concerted effort to dilute and destroy our national unity and national character. And this, of course, is being done in the service of making it easier to establish an internationalist, socialist, authoritarian state. Going along with that is everything you're talking about the World Health Organization and the Biden regime's efforts to sign over large portions of American sovereignty, giving the WHO overarching power to dictate to the United States and to other governments. That also coalesces with the erasure of the southern border and is all in service of the same agenda, to establish an authoritarian socialist government that is beyond the government of the United States, beyond the governments of Western Europe, ultimately hoping to encompass the entire world. Although, of course, I don't think they're going to get there.
Well, global governance is what they keep talking up. And It may be global governance under the governance of the Chinese Communist Party, but it may nonetheless be truly global, if you will. And Robert, there's so many points that need to be made in that regard. Let me simply say that to learn more about the growing recognition that this, if I can use your term, gambit of global governance has as one of its purposes intensifying these fissures and the prospect for violent suppression of those who oppose the left's agenda, check out at sovereigntycoalition.org this remarkable press conference led by Congressman Ralph Norman with the participation of some 18 or 19 of his colleagues on Wednesday of the past week. It's remarkable and really required viewing, sovereigntycoalition.org. Join us there at the American Sovereignty Declaration, if you would, as well. Robert, we've got one more break. We'll be right back with more right after this. We're back for the final installment of this remarkably interesting and, well, frankly, terrifying conversation with Robert Spencer, the author of so many books, I can't keep them straight, but the one that we've been specifically focused on today, of surpassing importance, is The Sumpter Gambit, about basically the times we're living in as the setup for the takedown of our republic by the left through a very much old-fashioned kind of tyranny, scaring us into submission and forcing us to conform. Robert, we had a taste of all of this back during the Trump presidency. In fact, it began, I guess, before he was elected president. John Durham, a special prosecutor commissioned to look into the whole Russian collusion drama, for want of a better term, finally released a report. It found, as I understand it, evidence that the whole thing was manufactured, that it was brought to us by Hillary Clinton's political campaign and her friends in government, notably Peter Strzok and people like him, James Comey and the FBI and so on. And neither they nor John Brennan nor Clapper nor any of these other characters who were involved in manufacturing the false narrative that Donald Trump was a Russian agent are to be prosecuted for what they did to clearly try to prevent the election and then subsequently to subvert the mandate given to Donald Trump as president of the United States. Your thoughts on the Durham report and how that ties into basically the thrust of what we've been discussing here today.
The Durham report demonstrates that all these people who were telling us all about Russian collusion regarding Trump for so many years were all lying, and they all knew that there was nothing to it from the beginning. And yet they continued, which shows how deeply corrupt they are, how deeply dishonest they are, and how opportunistic and self-serving they are. These people are all still in power. They will not be prosecuted. They will remain in power. And what they are trying to do is all part of the larger effort we've been discussing this hour. They are trying to criminalize dissent. And so one way to do that is to make the opposition appear to be beyond the pale of acceptable discourse, as Biden did in his red and black speech, and as the whole Russian collusion hoax was designed to do, to say, well, you think you're voting for an America First patriot, but he's actually a Russian agent in the employ of Vladimir Putin to undermine American interests. And so then people are confused. People turn against the America First idea because they think that it's really some sort of a disguise for Russian interests. And that fosters the same kind of stigmatization of the opposition that is in service of establishing an authoritarian regime that we see in so many other initiatives of the Biden regime in general.
I just want to say, I think you need to be clarified in one respect, and that is, I think these people are not in power in the sense that they hold the positions they previously did, but they're still in power in the sense that they're commentators on various media outlets and they are at large in the country, and their friends who were complicit in perpetrating this, and including some who are, yes, in the old-fashioned sense of the word, in power, maybe a little diminished in the sense that they're not running the House of Representatives at the moment. I'm thinking of people like Adam Schiff, for example, and Nancy Pelosi. But the power that is particularly worrying about all of this, Robert, as you understand better than just about anybody, is the power that is not always acknowledged and certainly not copped to, especially when it involves wrongdoing, criminal or otherwise. And that is the thing that has to be, I think, top of mind here. What they're doing to our country is pre or even actual revolutionary overthrow of our Constitution and replacement with a tyranny that they're hard at accomplishing, and that would be the end of America as we know it, and certainly what we would like to bequeath to our children. Robert, let me, just having said all of that, pivot to one last thing very quickly. The last time we spoke, we discussed efforts by the United States government under Joe Biden to undermine our relationship with Israel. It's extensive and unfortunately been rather effective. It's been combined recently with efforts to celebrate in official Washington the so-called Nakba, the catastrophe for the Palestinians. Bernie Sanders, among others, promoting this idea. Very quickly, what would you have us understand about how that fits into the larger rewriting of history as well as takedown of our traditional values and country?
Frank, the whole Nakba idea is a quintessential example of how the left rewrites history in order to push its agenda. The Arabs in 1948 were not thrown out of what is now the State of Israel. Actually, the Arab Higher Committee, as I document in my book, The Palestinian Delusion, ordered them to leave the area because the nations that were going to war with Israel in 1948 were confident of victory, and they thought, we'll destroy Israel, and then you can all go back home, but meanwhile, we don't want you in the line of fire. Well, they lost the war, and so they left voluntarily, and then they lost the war, so that's the fortunes of war. But now it has become this myth that the Israelis stole their land and threw them off it. And this terrible injustice has to be redressed by opposition to Israel in various ways. This is the entrenched policy of the Democrat Party at this point.
It is. It has become normalized anti-Semitism, really. It's not just anti-Zionism. Robert, so much more to talk with you about. I hope you'll come back for another long form very soon. But in the meantime, stay well, my friend, and for the great work that you do at jihadwatch.org. Godspeed. Come back to us, I hope. The rest of you as well next time. Until then, go forth and multiply.